Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Amidst all the talk of a green revolution, what about the blue stuff? There are the seas that will wash over inhabited land. There's the sea economy and fishermen and cargo crews facing hard times. And then there's all the debate about animal rights. Where do sea creatures fit into that? Professor Chris Armstrong is the author of A Blue New Deal, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It's great to be on.
And let's just understand the sort of scope of this book, because you're discussing lots of aspects of ocean policy, basically.
Yes, I am. It's quite a wide-ranging book, from, you know, as you say, the rights of animals to the rights of workers at sea, the environment, inequality in the ocean economy. It's all in there.
Yeah. And let's just start by understanding, obviously, oceans are important, but in what ways are they important? And one of the striking things you say, which, I mean, some people may be aware of, but many won't be, I suspect, that, yeah, they're probably more important than the rainforests in terms of absorbing carbon.
Yes, so there's some disagreement among scientists about the exact figures about whether the ocean is the biggest carbon sink, but it's there or thereabouts. It's also the biggest supplier of oxygen, if you like, which, again, we used to think was the role that the rainforest provided. We go to school and we get told that the rainforests are the lungs of the earth, but now we are increasingly thinking that the ocean is. That's largely because of plankton, which absorbs carbon dioxide, uses up the carbon, stores it away into the ocean food system, and then releases the oxygen.
I'm surprised there's uncertainty about that. I mean, these things must be quite easy to measure, or maybe not.
You would think so. I think our understanding of the exact proportions are a bit uncertain at the moment. Whether the rainforest or the plankton are in the number one position or the number two position, I think there's some debate.
Basically, the sea is more important than most people realise.
Absolutely, absolutely. It does many other things that we blithely ignore in our day-to-day lives, like it regulates temperature, it drives weather patterns that we rely upon.
Tell us about regulating temperatures. What is the role of the ocean in that?
Essentially, the idea is that water has a very high heat capacity. And by that, we just mean that you can throw lots and lots of heat into the ocean without it actually increasing its temperature very much. So, you know, lots of solar energy comes from the sun, hits our planet. If our planet was a kind of dusty, rocky planet, it would become very, very hot. But the ocean manages to absorb that energy, much of it, and disperse it rapidly. So these great ocean currents take heat energy away from the equator towards the poles, which is why, for example, the UK is much warmer than it would otherwise be, given that we're on roughly the same kind of latitude as Canada. The Gulf Stream transports heat energy from the equator up towards Northern Europe. So the ocean is a kind of a conveyor belt of heat, if you like.
And it's a moderating influence, in fact.
Yes. So the equator would probably be uninhabitable if it wasn't for the ocean taking away so much heat energy. Northern and very southern latitudes would be even colder than they are. So it's a kind of equalizing influence.
An obvious sort of importance of oceans, that they provide a lot of food.
Yes, they do. Hundreds of millions of people are, in one way or another, nutritionally dependent on the sea. The big story is obviously the fact that many people eat fish, but also the ocean is really important for some people in providing salt or, seaweed or various other inputs into their diet.
Now then, let's look at the problems. And you talked us through some of the important functions of oceans as far as humans are concerned. On the problems, I mean, I guess the one that people talk about most is sea rise. So how real is that? I mean, it seems to me that, as it may be the case in a lot of these claims about environmental degradation, that the dire predictions haven't happened as quickly as people say. What do you think?
there is a good deal of uncertainty when it comes to exactly how much sea level rise we can expect. And that's partly because there are kind of time lag effects. You know, even if we manage to decarbonize our economies right now, there is probably some sea level rise already locked in by our past emissions. But exactly how much sea level rise we're going to have is very much open for debate, because it partly depends on what we do. There are some dire predictions where we see sea level rise in the meters by the end of the century, which would be pretty catastrophic for many countries in Asia, but also North America and Europe and really lots of places. Sea level rise itself hasn't led to the loss of much territory, but there are problems around sea level rise that accompany it that are quite serious. So we often think with sea level rise about land literally kind of crumbling away into the ocean, but we also have to think about salt, for example, being absorbed into the land as, you know, waves rise and penetrate more of the soil. And if you are a farmer, you're not really going to grow crops on soil which has been salinated. So that's a kind of a worrying aspect around sea level rise that I think gets a bit less attention.
Okay, and let's sort of take another aspect then of the difficulties faced by the oceans. And plastic pollution is, you know, quite often discussed. Now, I mean, it seems to me the oceans are so vast. It seems extraordinary there'd be enough plastic out there to make a significant difference, but there is, isn't there?
Yes, I mean, the quantity of plastic that we're producing is absolutely vast. And some of it is recycled or, you know, stored away or buried on land, but lots of it finds its way into the rivers, gets washed into the sea. Because of the way that ocean currents work, it collects in various places. So we get the kind of Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is pretty vast. And it doesn't exactly look like a garbage patch, and it's not exactly piled high, but there are concentrations there of plastics and microplastics that are really worrying in the sense that they get eaten by, absorbed by organisms and pass away down the food chain. So the chief problem with plastic pollution in terms of marine animals like fish and birds is simply that they kind of inadvertently eat them, or they eat them believing that they are something, you know, nutritious. And because they can't be digested, they just remain in their stomachs or in their guts. They are full and they can't eat anymore. So eventually, you know, seabirds and fish can starve to death.
The result of the plastic and other aspects of environmental degradation are what you call marine dead zones. Can you talk us through them?
Yeah, so dead zones are chiefly associated with agriculture. So dead zones happen around the coast of places where intensive agriculture happens. So the problem is really nitrogen fertilizer. So when nitrogen is used on farmland, which has kind of produced incredible benefits in terms of the fertility of the soil, often it leaches its way again into the rivers, down to the oceans. And what it does there is it spurs the growth of lots and lots of algae. And the algae lives, but eventually dies. And when it dies, it sucks the oxygen out of the water. So dead zones are essentially parts of the ocean that have very low oxygen. So in those areas, we tend to find kind of shellfish, small fish, and then the bigger creatures that predate them. So, you know, porpoises, dolphins eventually dying. So dead zones are somewhat kind of devoid of life. So the Baltic Sea is one of the most famous examples, but also places off the coast of the US.
Then you move on to the people using the ocean and indeed the animals who exist in the ocean. So let's deal with the people first. I guess is it always been the case that mariners, you know, have pretty rough working conditions, tend to be underpaid, you know, marginal employment? Is that right, or is it worse now than it used to be?
The picture is slightly complicated. You're absolutely right that mariners, seafarers have always complained about the conditions. They've always argued that being out there on the open sea has exposed them to mistreatment, to, you know, a lack of food, a lack of pay. On the other hand, working in the ocean economy, becoming a seafarer, has also for many oppressed people been a kind of escape. So you might actually want to go out to sea as a way of escaping poverty or, you know, religious persecution or something along those lines.
So tell us a bit more about the situation now faced by people working on the sea.
Yeah, so I think one of the starting points here is to recognise that if you're out there as a seafarer in the ocean economy, fishing, for example, you inhabit this really distinctive legal position. We have this doctrine of flag state jurisdiction, which says essentially that, you know, each boat out there on the open ocean is a little kind of slice of one country's territory. So it would be sailing under the flag of one country or another. And people who own boats can choose which flag their vessels sail under. So what we see really is the emergence of what often get called flag of convenience countries, which are countries which are happy to hire out their flag, but don't really devote much effort to making sure that workers are protected or that environmental standards are protected. So in some places in the world, especially the Gulf of Thailand seems to be the kind of epicenter of abuse, we see some really terrible working conditions. So, you know, not just being overworked and deprived of pay, but deprived of medical care, sometimes being beaten and even killed and thrown overboard. Because these workers are geographically so far from help, but they're also sailing under the flag of a country which doesn't have much interest in protecting their rights.
Right, and some of the captains of these ships just sound terrible.
Out of sight, out of mind, right? The abuses that are possible out there, you know, 50 or 100 miles or 200 miles from any coastline are dreadful. There's a kind of impunity that opens up the possibility of abuse for unscrupulous employers.
And tell us about fish rights, if that's what I should call them, because animal rights have become a much bigger thing over the last 20, 30 years. People talking about them, trying to enforce them. I don't know why, but fish don't seem to get quite as much attention, except perhaps the whale, is it? So tell us what the sort of landscape of that is.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So in the law of the sea, so the kind of grand document of the law of the sea is the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea from 1982. I mean, it's a very long document. It discusses all kinds of issues. But one thing it never discusses is the idea that the creatures that actually live in the sea might have rights. So by and large, fish, for example, are treated as resources to be kind of argued over and haggled over within international law. The whales, as you kind of rightly mention, are a kind of partial exception to that, although what happens with whales historically is kind of interesting. So we get the emergence of, you know, whaling treaties, which initially are not really intended to protect whales in their own right at all. They're intended to protect whaling, right? Because it becomes obvious that there is so much whaling that the whales are going to disappear and that the industry is going to kind of bottom out. So initially, kind of international agreements on whaling are about making sure that the whales last, so as a resource. But over time, we get in the kind of emerging norm that whales are just not the kind of creature that we ought to be killing for, you know, oil or blubber. So that's the kind of the entry point, I guess, for many people for a discussion about the rights of the creatures that live in the ocean. But I think ideally it would go much further, right? Each, you know, distinctive life form in the ocean might intelligibly have its own kind of rights, depending on what vulnerabilities it has, depending on how we kind of impact on those creatures.
Is there anyone writing out there that there is a distinction between fish rights and animal rights?
There are philosophers who think there are differences. So, for example, there's a well-known American philosopher called Martha Nussbaum who thinks that we shouldn't hunt on land because that kind of treats land animals kind of as a means to an end, not as an end in itself. But she thinks that fishing, at least if it can be done relatively kind of painlessly with a high welfare standard, is not problematic. So she thinks there's some kind of distinction morally between fish and other animals. I'm not so sure. I think the kind of standard arguments for why animals have rights are probably going to apply to fish as well. I think fish are kind of capable of and vulnerable in ways that we don't necessarily recognize.
And presumably one of the differences, which is something you talk about anyway, is whether animals are farmed or not. I mean, that can be, you know, relevant morally. And let's just say that you're making a point in the book that there's much more aquaculture than there used to be, right?
Yeah, we're right now on the cusp of aquaculture replacing wild fishing as a source of fish for the global economy, as a source of protein for our diets. So we are, I think, in the decades to come, we will probably look back and think, kind of odd in some ways that we used to, you know, roam out on the open ocean scooping up fish rather than farming them. Aquaculture is growing very rapidly, whereas populations of wild fish, as we know, are, you know, declining in many ways.
Now, presumably, that, I mean, yeah, there's nothing wrong with that, right? I mean, agriculture has worked very well for humans, and there's been a very long history of the relationship between humans and farmed animals. So should we view aquaculture negatively?
I mean, if you take a strong animal rights position, I guess there's not that much difference between, you know, fishing wild fish and agriculture. You are probably infringing the rights of the fish involved. You're kind of killing them unnecessarily, subjecting them to, I mean, in the case of aquaculture, that the main worries are about crowding and disease and so on. Add on to that, there are some distinctive environmental worries about aquaculture. So, you know, lochs in Scotland where salmon are farmed, environmental activists report back that, you know, if you look underneath the pens that these salmon are kept in, there isn't much life because we get, you know, chemicals put into the water. We get lots of kind of fish feces that descends down, and we get this quite barren stretch of seabed underneath. So there are environmental worries about fish farming, and there are, of course, animal rights, animal welfare worries too.
In most of those things, as in farming, right, as in farming on land, could be fixed, yes, by better regulation. I mean, you know, no doubt some of the farming practices of 100 years ago are considered totally unacceptable now. And, you know, with the fishing, you've made the point already, it's a bit out of sight. So it may take longer for proper regulation to come in, I guess.
Yes, you're right. So we could farm fish differently. One peculiarity of fish farming is that the fish that consumers prefer to eat are carnivorous fish, right? So salmon and prawns and so on, they essentially eat other fish. And that has kind of major environmental consequences because we get these boats, you know, sailing around places like the Gulf of Thailand, scooping up pretty much everything that moves and grinding them up to make fish meal to feed these fish, which doesn't look like a great model, right, in lots of ways environmentally. But there are alternatives. I mean, you know, farming mussels and oysters looks really different from the point of view both of welfare and impact on the environment. So one of the big differences would be that you don't need to feed oysters or mussels at all, right? You simply kind of, in the case of mussels, you might lower a kind of rope or a framework into the ocean, come back a year later and it'll be covered in mussels, and you simply pick them off and transport them away. So there's an environmental footprint in the fuel and so on, but the environmental footprint is much, much lower than in the case of, let's say, salmon farming.
Yeah. Just in that context, let me ask you about, I mean, funny enough, I live by the sea, and there's someone in the village I live in who is trying to set up a project to farm seaweed. Which sounds, you know, interesting and quite, he says, not as difficult as you'd think. Is that happening? Is that something you're aware of?
Yes, it is. And it's been a big thing in Asia for a long time, as you might expect, but it's emerging in Europe and North America. Seaweed can actually be used in all kinds of ways. You know, we can eat seaweed. You can give seaweed as a dietary supplement to cattle, for example, and scientists say that cattle that are fed seaweed supplements emit, if you like, less methane, which is great for the climate. So seaweed is a very kind of versatile product, but it also doesn't really seem to have negative environmental impact. So seaweed farming is, again, a relatively straightforward operation. So you don't need to use fertilizers, you don't need to use pesticides, you simply let the seaweed grow. And while the seaweed grows, it kind of acts as a nursery for lots of marine life. So you might find, you know, the seahorses returning. You might find lots of crustaceans returning. So it looks like a win-win, really, in an environmental way. So seaweed farming may well be a kind of an interesting and positive part of the future, I think.
And where does tidal energy come into all of this? Because it does seem, you know, a solution to the energy crisis in some ways, in that it's obviously very green and it is predictable, unlike wind power. But I'm seeing that there are environmental objections to having turbines on the floor. I mean, it would seem to me there is such a tiny amount of the floor space would be used by these turbines that it would be surprising if they made a big impact. But how do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a difficult and complicated question. You're absolutely right that tidal power has this big advantage, which is that it's really, really predictable, right? So unlike wind and solar, we can pretty much count on the tides. There are concerns. I mean, maybe there are especially concerns about these kind of big tidal barrages. So, you know, if you kind of put a barrage of installations across the whole of the Severn, for example, then this might have a big impact on ecosystems. It might prevent fish kind of spawning in the places they're used to spawning. It might prevent marine mammals from reaching where they want to get to. On the smaller scale, maybe those worries are less serious. So, yeah, I mean, I think the jury's out. I think undoubtedly tidal power looks like it's going to be part of the energy mix we need. We're in a position where beggars can't be choosers, really. But how big a part of the future it's going to be, the energy mix in the future, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, just one thought about these barrages. I mean, again, just in the area I'm in, the Victorians put up barrages which have created parts of the seascape that are now considered very special environmentally. You know, that they've had a beneficial effect on the environment. No doubt, yeah, massive interventions in a way, building these huge constructions that, you know, to take roads across the sea and to protect harbours and so on. I mean, do you think sometimes that these interventions are not necessarily all negative?
Yeah, I mean, I think you make an important point, which is that we can't imagine that there is some kind of very neat and everlasting distinction between land and sea, right? That the barrier between land and sea changes, and often it changes as a result of, you know, human ingenuity. So, you know, countries like the Netherlands or Singapore have grown as a result of the reclamation of the sea. But by the same token, we can also restore. We can restore wetlands. We can give land back to the sea. So part of the discussion about climate change is undoubtedly, I mean, this is a big public debate in the Netherlands, it's undoubtedly about which bits of the land do we choose to give up, right, in order to protect what we want to protect. So there's certainly not some kind of hard and fast line on a map in the way that an atlas might make you think. There is a big collective decision or set of decisions in many countries that need to be made about exactly what our coastlines are going to look like in the future.
Let's move on now to, you know, solutions to some of these problems and looking ahead as to what might be done. I mean, one of the things you say, I'm rather surprised it still happens, is that, you know, there should be a ban on cyanide and dynamite when fishing. Where does that happen?
This happens in the Caribbean in particular, but also off the coast of Africa. It's essentially a very cheap and not particularly technologically advanced way of gathering lots and lots of fish, right? So you throw the dynamite into the water and it explodes, and the shortly afterwards the fish kind of float belly up, and you gather them all and you sell them. It's destructive, and often, depressingly, it happens where the fish are quite close to the surface in places like coral reefs. So in those places, it's hugely destructive.
Yeah, and then you talk about harmful fishing subsidies. Tell us what the, you know, where that's happening and what the impact is.
Yeah, so it might be interesting there to talk about the high seas. So in international law, there's this distinction between, you know, each country's bit of marine territory, its exclusive economic zone, and then the high seas. The border there is 200 nautical miles out to sea. Stops being your bit of marine territory and becomes the high seas. Now, the thing about high seas fishing is that, according to economists, it's a completely irrational practice, because it costs you as much or more to fuel your fishing boat to get as far as the high seas as you are likely to catch, right? So it's a kind of very strange practice, in fact, that high seas fishing exists at all, but it does exist because several countries subsidize their high seas fleets because the domestic fishing lobby is powerful in those countries, or because they've kind of overfished their own bits of marine territory and they need to roam further afield to get access to fish somewhere else. So the high seas, we get this strange kind of economically irrational phenomenon of these five or six countries just scooping up lots and lots of fish, carrying them back and damaging marine ecosystems in the process to no real kind of economic end.
Well, but there is an end nutritionally, right? Because that fish is feeding people. So any solution to that would have to include a plan to replace that nourishment.
Yes, it would. The thing I would say in response to that is that the poorer people of the world who are, understandably dependent on fish for their diets are not really fishing on the high seas, right? They can't afford to get there. They're engaged in what we call kind of artisanal fishing, which is fishing within about kind of 10 to 12 miles of the coast, which is roughly where you can, row your way out to and back within a day, right, before night falls. High seas fishing is big business by and large. We get these big kind of fishing outfits which gain these fuel subsidies from their governments, which allows them to go on fishing on the high seas. I don't think that the impact on the diets of poor people would be very serious if we ended high seas fishing tomorrow. I mean, at least some fisheries economists think that the nutritional impact would be fairly modest. Actually, it might be positive, right? Because one idea about the high seas is that if we simply close the high seas to fishing, it would just act as this kind of great spawning ground or breeding ground, and we would see more fish in states' marine territories appearing.
I mean, you'll be familiar with those stories of nets that drag the surface of the ocean, the floor of the ocean, and just scoop up everything. It sounds absolutely bonkers that it's allowed. Is that what the high seas fishing is? Are they the ones that use those nets?
Yeah, they do in some cases. So there are these things called seamounts in the high seas, which are a bit like kind of mountains that don't quite make it to the surface. So they're kind of underwater mountains. And they are, because the high seas in some ways is a bit of a desert biologically, what fish life there is tends to congregate around, physical features like, it might be plastic garbage patches or it might be seamounts. These seamounts get dredged pretty regularly. It takes fish a long time to recover from that, right? So in some ways, there's this kind of interesting analogy. In some ways, these trawling operations on the high seas look a bit more like mining than they do kind of farming, in the sense that they destroy the ecosystem on these seamounts. It isn't going to return, possibly for decades, rather than farming where you think you can kind of sustainably do this year on year.
Well, yes, it's interesting you say that, though, because one of the striking claims in your book is that marine ecosystems recover faster than terrestrial ones. And I was very struck by that. And, well, first of all, can you give an example of that?
So there is this really interesting historical example, which, of course, we wouldn't want to repeat, but it's kind of what economists call a natural experiment. And the example is the Second World War, where, German U-boats were buzzing around the North Atlantic, for example. Fishermen were not able to go out to sea. And then in 1945, when they went out to sea once more, after a break of, 5 or 6 years, they were stunned by the number of fish that were out there in the sea. So it looks as though if we just give them the chance, fish populations are incredibly resilient. They will bounce back. We've been testing that hypothesis to the limits, though, because, of course, the chance to bounce back is exactly what we haven't been giving fish populations.
But isn't that what happened actually in the case of cod in the Atlantic, that there was a moratorium on it and it worked? Yeah, they did bounce back.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, this is the flip side of the story. If we just give them the chance, fish populations. So marine biologists talk about the importance of these. So unlike kind of humans or land-based animals, the older a fish gets, the bigger it gets, the more fertile it gets. So it's especially important when we establish things like marine protected areas that we give them a few years to prove their worth, because eventually we'll get these big, super fertile fish whose kind of eggs row, whose young will start radiating out into the surrounding seas relatively quickly.
When you look ahead, you've talked about a World Ocean Authority. What are the obstacles to doing some of the things you're talking about, you know, to not using dynamite, not using trawlers that sort of wreck the ocean floor, you know, creating systems that allow stocks to recover? Why is all that so difficult?
So one thing I would say is that in the book, I try to do two different, but I think complementary things. When it comes to the high seas, I go straight for the big picture and say, you know, what would an ideal solution look like? I spin this yarn about a World Ocean Authority that in a sense would be an environmental guardian for the whole of the high seas. So, you know, perhaps it would not allow any fishing on the high seas. Perhaps it would outlaw deep sea mining, probably because of its likely environmental impact. And I understand that this is not likely to happen anytime soon. So recently we had a high seas treaty that was much, much less ambitious than that. But then the flip side of that is closer to home. This is the second part of the story where each state has its own bit of marine territory. I give a number of examples of things that individual states could do and in some cases have done to nurture marine ecosystems back to health. So we do have some good news story that wouldn't require a huge amount of kind of institutional innovation.
Okay, and so when you look ahead, are you optimistic that this will get traction as an issue? Because I could see lots of reasons why it wouldn't. I mean, many of which you've stated, you know, it all happens a long way away. There are many other more pressing problems, perhaps, you know, or more immediate problems. Are you optimistic?
I am unguardedly optimistic. And the reason for that is that I think interest in the ocean is growing rapidly. So certainly whenever I go and talk to people about the ocean, you know, I don't have to persuade people how interesting and important this is. There is a great kind of untapped audience out there. And I say untapped because I think it is untapped by our politicians, who don't particularly get around to campaigning on ocean-facing issues, with a few exceptions. Often what happens is that kind of ordinary citizens find themselves joining up these kind of great public-spirited and noble environmental activities, like, you know, clearing up plastic from beaches and campaigning about sewage, you know, organizations like Surfers Against Sewage. But they don't really know what comes next. And I think we're kind of missing a democratic politics of the ocean in many ways.
Well, yes, but no one's elected to represent the oceans, are they?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And governments don't tend to have ministers for the ocean. They often have ministers for fishing, which is not quite the same thing. It would be wonderful if politicians did campaign on ocean-facing issues, but I think they're not going to do that until enough voters ask them why they are not doing that, right? Why, until they get enough kind of letters from concerned citizens, or it might be NGOs, to say, well, look, what is your vision for the ocean by 2050 or by the end of the century? What kind of ocean economy do you want to see? What kind of ocean environment do you want to see?
And as you studied this, writing this book, what surprised you most of all? What did you discover that you thought, gosh?
One of the things that surprised me most was the incredible vulnerability of workers in the ocean economy. So the chapter I had on people who work in fishing on the high seas and, you know, the Gulf of Thailand was horrifying. I wasn't entirely surprised that abuses happened, but the kind of sheer vulnerability and the sheer scale of the abuses is pretty shocking. Aside from that, I think I've just come to learn more and more about the kind of many ways in which we depend on the ocean, environmentally, socially, economically, which I think were not quite obvious to me. So in that sense, it was definitely a kind of voyage of discovery.
And it has been for us too. So Professor Chris Armstrong, thanks very much for taking us on it. And it's a good topic, which, as you say, hasn't received an awful lot of attention. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.